I went out to dinner with a sanguine who said I was really hesitant about VR because when I first tried it, I was so excited and it sucked. But then when he tried the Oculus, he bought one and he said he lost 48 hours just living in it. And that when he came out of it, he had reality sickness. And I said, that's the most sanguine thing I've ever heard.
Have you ever wondered why it is that we do what we do and who we do it with? Then this is a podcast for you. An exploration of human beings through systemic psychology and Unani biotypes. With Rodrigo Garcia Plates, Ross Everett, and Brian McElhaney. This is Biotypical.
I wonder if VR is a fad or the future. Because a part of me is like, it's the future, and part of me is like, I don't know. This thing is fun, but you can kind of get... You can kind of overdose on it, and it's not catching on. I mean, it is, but not like wildfire, I would say.
I like the split theory, where half the people are going to fully immerse themselves into VR, and half of them are going to reject it. And then we're going to have a world of fully immersed technological people, and we're going to have a world of like people that are returning back to the woods and the other ways of living.
And then when we war, it'll be like cave people fighting holograms.
Exactly, exactly.
Who would you be, a cave person or a hologram?
Oh my gosh. I think I'd be a cave person.
Me too.
Yeah. Rodrigo,
I am
hologram.
So lost in this conversation.
Rodrigo,
I think I can't be a cave person. And I think the moment the war started, I'd be like, we made the wrong choice, Ross.
Yeah.
The holograms are beating our asses.
Yeah. But all we would need is like, you know, super soakers because that technology can't. Actually, everything's water resistant now. That
you just get it wet.
Water anymore. Yeah.
I feel like augmented reality is the future, not virtual reality.
But you need the headset to see the augmented reality. So I have a friend that
is... Not necessarily. Google Glass.
Yeah, but it was just so weird. I have a friend that was like working in developing an Oculus and all this stuff. And I went over to try out some stuff. And it was like flowers were growing out of the ground of this living room that we were in. I was like, wow, this is pretty amazing. I can see why people would want to live in this. But here's the thing with augmented reality. Like the dystopian brain that I have goes, you like look around, you're like, the world is beautiful, but you just take it off and like Rome is burning around you. The building that you're in is just like, they've Febrezed the shit out of it because there's just stains all over it. The white walls are now a deep yellow.
I'm sorry, I drifted off for a second. What are you talking about, Ross?
Welcome to Biotypical. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
it was hard to keep up.
Maybe I didn't do a good enough job painting this picture. But you know what? I'm not too attached to it. I'm willing to bail ship. Matt says Ready Player One. Absolutely.
That movie was amazing.
Did you read the book? I love the book. I just read Ready Player Two as well. Oof.
Oh,
so yeah, I think Spielberg's been doing great in the last couple of years.
Who?
Spielberg.
Oh, yes.
Steven Spielberg. He's this up-and-coming director. He's on the indie circuit right now.
Esteban Spielberg.
Yeah, that's right. He's a foreign filmmaker.
Yeah. For Rodrigo, that's true.
that's very true. It's not even a joke for Rodrigo.
There was something
what are we talking about today?
We're going to talk
Who
about...
Who are we? What are we doing?
We're talking about the term is avoiding me. We talked about it right before everybody hopped on. What is it?
You're talking about imposter syndrome?
Thank you, imposter syndrome.
Are we all really tired today? I am, and I feel like you guys might be matching me here.
But yeah, well, I gotta be the
dude,
thermostat,
not the
thermometer.
Dude, I woke up at 5 a.m. and just got off a plane.
Yeah, okay, very good.
You made it in time.
So let's get a little loopy. Let's play some One Direction, see what happens, you know.
Okay, good luck with this episode, guys. Bye.
I remember what I wanted to bring up. We need to issue a correction because we've said it both ways before.
Adam Do they Sandler, slam their beaks off?
Do they? Yeah. No. Eagles, we're going back on our Eagles thing. Adam Sandler, we've discussed him as a fake fire, we've discussed him as a sanguine.
But we started calling him a sanguine a while ago.
We've gone back and forth about it. I've absolutely heard it both ways. But I've been watching Jack and Jill Which, by the way,
why were you doing that?
You know what? Because it was late at night. I needed something to fall asleep to. And I was like, you know what? Like a mindless Adam Sandler movie that I haven't seen. Because I skipped Jack and Jill because the reviews were so freaking terrible about it.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I made jokes about Jack and Jill without seeing it.
I've given it a chance.
I've laughed out loud multiple times watching this movie, and I am like, I'm coming out as I think Jack and Jill is a way better movie than it has gotten credit for.
Now, would you say it's up to speed of the original Adam Sandler's?
No, like we grew up but with? I would put it up, like, it's not sweet like Click, but it is, like, as far as comedies go, I've laughed more at Jack and Jill than I have at, like, the past six Adam Sandler movies. It's better than Hubie Halloween.
Okay,
hands down.
Would you put it,
oh, what a bar to clear.
Put it in, like, a ladder of, like, the best movies that Adam Sandler has ever made? Like, what's
all right,
your
well, I think, you know what?
And where
let's do this.
Like?
You know,
number one
is between
is
Happy Gilmore or we're talking comedies. We're not talking like throw
uncut
out the punch
gems,
truck limbs.
It's one of the most depressive and like accurate psychological portrayals that you can see.
I was like in the theater, like this is, I've never been more uncomfortable in my goddamn life watching this guy. It's thrilling.
Yeah. It was
in,
a really
kind of the
hard
worst way,
movie to
but
watch.
I love it.
We even talked about it, and this is where I think we came to terms with Adam Sandler being a sanguine, which that movie is such a perfect portrayal of sanguine's shame and their inability to just stop and ask for support when they're in the middle of a meltdown and still saying yes to everything and promising that in the next corner they're going to fix their lives. Like, that's such a sanguine experience. I feel like that's where he can portray it, like, so accurately.
Interesting.
I mean, watching Jack and Jill, you see his quads because he's wearing a dress. He's wearing like a dress that goes above his knee in a lot of these things. And I'm like, these are massive. Like, I was like, end of story. Like, these are massive. But, okay, this is going reverse.
Look
at this.
Podcast,
at this list,
we look
the worst
at Adam
one.
Sandler's legs.
Yes.
Welcome, everyone. Ridiculous 6 is 0%.
I agree with that. I didn't even finish Ridiculous 6. I gave that one a shot.
I never even watched it.
Jack and Jill has 3.
I couldn't finish it. Jack and Jill has a 3%, which is
Wow.
This now watching this, like, this is offensive. This is absolutely offensive that this has a 3%.
Ross is offended.
Like, I was
right,
so surprised when I...
Is Ross becoming, like, the clear, like, vocal left wing on this podcast?
Because I'm standing for Jack and Jill? This is a hill I'm willing to die on.
Dude, you're saying,
I'm not sure
you're
what
saying
in
that
this
a Rotten Tomatoes
sense is
like,
making him
is offensive. Like...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes.
Oh,
you're triggered,
because of
Ross,
that
is what we're saying.
No, I'm phlegmatic. I don't get angry. I get offended. I feel personally slighted that Jack and Jill has a 3%. Ridiculous
now,
6, I agree
with.
I'm aligned with that.
Ross, that's a slippery slope, my friend.
No.
I'm holding a sign in a corner.
No. You know what? I'm going to go up to the Rotten Tomatoes offices and I'm going to, this is the hill I die on, right? I've got my shirt that, you know, Jack and Jill is underappreciated.
8% or bust.
Like, honestly, like, if we're looking like Grown Ups 2, Bulletproof, I remember really liking because I was also a big Damon Wayans fan growing up. Do Over, 9%. Fine with that. Mixed Nuts, hardly an Adam Sandler film. Now we're getting into 8 Crazy Nights.
I
actually,
you know,
really
I think
well.
I'm going to stop you before we spend this podcast going through Adam Sandler movies. For the people listening, trying to get some insight into relationships.
Mr. Deeds has a 22%. You know what? I think credits.
I think this might be something to discuss off air.
Really?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying that
there's no way that. I'm looking at these movies right now, and I would absolutely put it. Well, Waterboy should definitely be higher on this list.
Waterboy is probably his worst movie.
No. Incorrect.
Waterboy deserves that 3%.
I would say, you know what? Actually, I think Big Daddy is maybe his best, but Billy Madison.
What the hell is Billy Madison?
You've never seen Billy Madison?
Big movie.
Oh my God.
He goes
God,
back to school God. As an adult.
I will say
kindergarten and go through all the grades.
There's a nostalgia filter on my reviews of this. So, like the Billy Madisons, the Happy Gilmores, those are ones that see. Look, Hubie Halloween is a 52%. Jack and Jill deserves to be hanging around there.
You know, I have not seen either, so I can't comment. Hubie
Halloween, I enjoyed. It was like a fun, like okay, Halloween, we're gonna watch an Adam Sandler movie, whatever. It was enjoyable. But I will say, Jack and Jill has me laughing out loud. I'm not even finished with it. And I understand, like, people are, like, upset about fart jokes. We're at the 12-minute mark of...
Yeah, let's just see how long we can go.
How long we can go on the Adam Sandler train. But either way, he's absolutely sanguine. Like, the Russ, yeah.
They're asking for the movie corner song in Biotypical.
Dan, that's a Dan question. Dan, where's our Dan? Biotypical movie corner song? You know what? Dan... Here's what it's going to be a film resound. Okay, yeah, okay. Welcome to Biotypical Movie Corner. Yeah.
Bam-a-dam, biotypes in movies.
What?
Brought to you by Eric Cartman.
Leave me alone, I'm tired.
Hired some goblin under a bridge to do the opening intro for our movie section.
What do you guys think the number one Adam Sandler comedy is?
Click.
I haven't seen Click.
No.
Oh, it's hard because those ones when I was a kid, I loved. And I can't even look at them with objective eyes because I just loved Happy Gilmore so much as a 10-year-old. So
Happy Gilmore's was number my favorite
8 back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
I mean, I also loved Waterboy, but I think it probably was bad. But I was 10 and I liked
Waterboy. Is catastrophic. But there is a phrase from Happy Gilmore that I've quoted a million times and I love it. I eat pieces of shit like you for breakfast. You eat pieces of shit for breakfast?
Classic.
Yes.
Classic line.
Yes. Incredible. No, the number one is Funny People. I don't like this list. I don't like this list at all. Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, you found it.
I don't like any list. Who makes any lists?
You know what? I wonder if Ranker has it. Because that's more like people voting on this shit.
I feel like we got to go move on somewhere else. Okay, let's look at another list of Adam Sandler movies.
Jack and Jill is consistently in like the bottom two or three.
Brian, do you know who likes making lists?
Who likes making lists?
Schindler.
Healthy Melancholics.
Oh.
Yeah, well, that's what I hear. I hope they have a great time. I like making lists in like comedic essays. I like doing that, like listing fictional things.
Oh, when is the time that you've done that, Brian?
I just did it.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's celebrate Brian for a second. Brian had his first piece published in The New Yorker.
Yeah, I was very excited. There's a thing called Shouts and Murmurs where people post like humorous essays and like some of my favorite writers like Simon Rich, who I love, who... runs the show Miracle Workers, and like Jack Handy, who did all the Deep Thoughts. They always like publish their stuff there first, and I'm just a fan of it so much. So
while you're in New York, you should carry around a copy in the streets and just stop people and say,
"I think it's only digital." So I just carry on my phone and show everyone.
If it was only published digitally, were you really published?
The answer is no, but we're going to ignore that and just say yes.
Well, it depends on where the servers are held. And in that case, you can be sued in that state for libel.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
For libel against these fictitious characters.
J.K. Rowling is going to sue you in the state of Vermont somehow. Or it wasn't Vermont. What it was? It was Virginia. That, do you know that that's the reason why the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial was in Virginia? Because the Washington Post online servers are hosted there. And then Johnny Depp's team was like, well, Virginia has the most like relaxed laws around intimidation. So we're going to sue her in the state of Virginia. And they were able to because that's where the servers are hosted for the Washington Post or wherever she published that editorial.
Oh, they're saying in the chat that it's Amazon Web Services.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to sue you for libel, they could go ahead. And Virginia's got a whole new industry booming of libel lawsuits coming through because that's where the Amazon cloud servers are hosted. But that's bonkers.
It's also perfect that they televised the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. It was such a shit show. The whole thing was a shit show. I'm glad it's over. We'll never speak of it again, right?
Oh, we need to speak about it again.
You're right, because Johnny Depp actually is in Jack and Jill, and he's hysterical in it. I'm not even kidding. Yes, he does a cameo. He's at the Lakers game when Al Pacino meets Jill. I'm telling you guys, he's in it. Yes. Everything comes back to Jack and Jill.
I am so confused. Okay, but we need to talk about Johnny Depp and Amber Heard because there is a new piece of information that has come to my attention that's very disturbing.
What? I haven't kept up with any of this shit.
Okay, little disclaimer. This is not verified information. This is not biotypical verified information. This is just gossip.
This is hearsay?
This is absolute hearsay. Objection, Your Honor.
All right. I'm getting ready to Google this.
Everything we do is just gossip. Let's be honest. We're a bunch of gossipers.
So I don't know if you can even validate this in Google, but...
Then should we even bring it up and spread it further?
Yes, because this matters.
Here's how I would like you to say it then. Could you propose it as a hypothetical situation in which person A and person... Oh, motherfucker. Okay,
you're trying to desanguine the sanguine here.
Don't overcomplicate this. Like, I'm actually concerned about this.
Okay. If it's true.
I'm concerned if it's true.
Okay.
let me put it this way. The reason I want to share this information is because if this is true, we need to do something about it.
Okay. Let's hear...
Like, as a society.
Let's hear the issue.
Okay. So, the issue is the following. So... In the middle of the trial, we found out that someone had been paying the legal fees and someone had also been paying.
Is this part true or is this part the hearsay?
Oh, everything I've said so far is true. Like, okay. We didn't know who was paying for her legal fees. And then now people are saying that her legal fees were $6 million and she needs to pay another 15, 13 if you remove the two that they awarded her. And at the same time, it was concerning to find out that she had like some sort of romance with Elon Musk because they showed videos of them like late at night while she was still married with Johnny Depp in an elevator, kind of making out with Elon Musk. And then we found out in the trial that Elon Musk was the one that gave, I believe, like $500,000 or $300,000 to the ACLU or whatever that thing is called. And now, in the rumor mill and YouTube, there's people saying that, like, Amber Heard might have something on Elon Musk, and that's why he's paying for all the legal fees. And now they're saying that there might be, like, some sort of sexual scandal that she could create, like, for him, and that's why there's so many people protecting her, because they're actually protecting Elon Musk. I don't know if it's true. I just don't want my beloved Elon Musk to be pinned down by anything.
He's already a little fucked, but okay.
Oh my God. Your beloved Elon Musk, Ross's beloved Adam Sandler. My God, guys, the world is coming after your heroes.
Look, I just.
Why, think Brian? It's why?
Completely unfair that Jack and Jill got so skewered. Like, I didn't even give it a chance. I think part of it is I just feel ashamed that I judged it based off of popular opinion.
Did you just completely not care about my Elon Musk comment?
Yeah, because it's all hearsay.
Like into Jack and Jill.
Like it's like, oh, if this thing that potentially could, like, I just Googled everything as you were saying it, and I couldn't find anything that was like substantial about it. So, I mean, like, you know,
I mean, that's true, Ross. But I'm always finding out shit that becomes official a few months later.
That has happened too, and if it becomes official in a few months, we could definitely address it. But for now, it's like there's nothing that we could do without any proven anything. Like I tried to even Google the video of them making out in the elevator, and I didn't see that. I saw her making out with some director while she was theoretically with Elon Musk, but like
no, but I saw the videos of her with Elon Musk in the elevator.
That was her. I saw the James Franco video.
No, there was one with James Franco and one with Elon Musk, and she was only wearing, like, a blanket.
What? And they're making out? Oh, yeah, Amber Heard, Elon Musk. She's wearing a trench coat. And they're hugging. They're like, that's only a blanket. Never mind. I'm seeing this.
I told you.
Yeah, okay. I'm doing our best to try and verify the things as we bring it up. We won't ever really speculate about the science of biotypes necessarily, but, you know, for this kind of pop culture hearsay stuff.
I just literally feel like I know that Elon Musk isn't perfect, like not even close. No. Like, I just really enjoy living in a world in which someone like him is doing multiple impossible things at the same time. And I enjoy the technology he brings. I really don't want him to stop.
But here's the thing is, like, it takes an arrogant asshole like that. What do we say? How you do one thing is how you do everything. So if you're going to go against society to prove the impossible possible, like he's been doing with the innovation in electric cars and all this jazz, you are someone who believes that the rules don't apply to you in some way, shape, or form. The things that society says that you can't do, the royal you, the person who would be the innovator.
Oh, okay.
Like, we have yet to have a real true innovator that's like, okay, well, I'm going to follow these rules, but I'm going to break these ones to create the impossible.
I have a question to bring it finally to what we wanted to talk about. Can you have imposter syndrome and become a game changer in the world of technology, politics, life, everything in general? Or do you have to kind of have the opposite of imposter syndrome, the thing of like, I'm great.
Delusion.
Yeah, because if you have imposter syndrome, where you think you're an imposter, everything you do, is your belief always going to stop you from ever being fully great or, you know, doing something that, do you need to have some sort of like crazy ego to be one of the people that we perceive as people who move this world forward?
I never thought the day would come where Brian was going to like get us back on track.
All right.
That was so elegant. That was really good.
Every comedic bone in my body wants to take us back off track right now, but I do want to hear the answer to that question.
Well, first we need to break it down, because I don't think there's anybody in the world that has done anything meaningful without imposter syndrome. Because imposter syndrome is part of the movement. Let's define it. Like, what do we understand as imposter syndrome?
No matter how successful you get, you feel like you don't deserve it and you aren't good enough, I think. Or like at the highest echelon of success, you're like, I don't, like, these people think I'm something that I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Can you see how that is, like, given what you know about the human mind and how the ego works, can you see how that's perfectly normal for anyone who's pushing boundaries forward and being seen by other people like someone who's making something grow or just creating a result that didn't exist?
Yeah, so it's almost like you have to have imposter syndrome in order to accomplish anything, because otherwise you're not trying to prove anything to anyone.
I had it flipped in my mind, of course.
It's kind of all the way around. But the thing is, if you're achieving something, you will have imposter syndrome, because we've all had like a very brief example of what imposter syndrome is growing up. When, for example, we say a very funny joke and a lot of people laugh, or you say a really interesting fact and a lot of people get it and they like it, and then they look at you like maybe there's another one coming,
or maybe there's something more to you than I thought before. Now they're expecting just, I don't know, some kind of new you there, or it's like they're looking at you and you're like, ah, fuck, I don't know what just happened, but I don't have more to offer, I don't think. Or that might have even been a fluke what I offered, but like I've taken up some new space in your head that I don't even know if I'm supposed to be there.
Brian, I have a question for you.
You must ask it.
Do you think do you think you're funny? Like, do you think you're a good enough comedian?
Oh,
I don't even know if I call myself a comedian.
You wouldn't call yourself a comedian?
I guess I do, because I do that. I think when I was growing up, I was pretty shy as a kid, and I know there's a long answer, but I was pretty shy, and no one would be like, oh, that guy's a class clown, or it took me a while to just sort of open up, but I wanted to be funny, and there were a lot of kids around me who were very naturally funny, and I think even now when I'm around like comedians or just in groups, I can kind of quiet down and I don't ever really feel like I'm the funniest person in the room. I do believe that I make really funny stuff. Like when I write or create or put on a show or edit something, I think I'm really good at crafting comedy. which I think I put a distinction between that and just like being funny.
Yeah, is that disassociating himself from his outcome right there by saying like oh, the things I create are funny, but that's not me.
That's a little bit of his imposter syndrome.
Yeah, probably to some degree, sure.
I have $10 million, Brian, and I want to give it to you to produce a movie. But the deal
you
is...
You can't. He's not really a comedian.
Yeah, but I'm like, do you? If I give you just a blank check or like a $10 million check, that's like, you here's this money, but you have to do something with it. You have to use it to make a movie. Do you accept or do you like get overwhelmed?
Immediately. Yes, definitely. Immediately. Yes. I would love to. If it was to make a movie, absolutely. That would not be a problem.
What would you have a hard time accepting $10 million to do?
I mean, not much, really.
Maybe I'm approaching this incorrectly.
You guys are having a whole conversation like surrounding Brian's imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I was like, I'm going to ask you, Rodrigo, what would be the perfect statement or offer to trigger Brian's imposter syndrome?
Well, I don't even know if I have it. You know, let's define what it is exactly. You know, it's
yes, you do have it. Like, dude, you saying that you don't consider yourself a comedian when, like, literally probably 99% of the money that you've made in your life is because you're funny is mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I think it's, you know what it is? When I was younger, I never thought I was going to be that. I was like, I'll be an actor or I'll be a director. And so I think in my head, I'm like, those are the things I want to hold on to. Comedian was never the image I put in my head when I was young. And so it's like, I sort of then became that. And in my head, I'm like, oh, I'm not that though. I'm this kind of masquerading as that over here for a while.
Russ, are you understanding what this is?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like through my lens, what are you thinking? Are you thinking what I'm thinking, Brian?
I think I am. But Brian has a preemptive, like through humility, imposter syndrome.
I mean, so when I look at Brian, and this, I guess we're putting Brian microscope episode, but I'm always surprised that he doesn't think of himself higher or bigger. Like, because I'm like, you're Brian McElhaney. Like every filmmaker that's anything in comedy has watched your videos and laughed at it. You have open doors all around you. Like every single door around Brian is absolutely unlocked, and some of them are even creaked open, but he just keeps walking down the hallway for some reason. Like,
yeah, look, I'm no wallflower. It's not like I'm still working in this industry and doing stuff. Like
But you, I don't think avoiding it. From my perspective, I'm like, you've never asked for a favor or like a, hey, could you introduce me? Or like, hey, I'm ready for this. Like now's
the
time.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I know who you're talking about too. It's like, there's like, we were talking about it yesterday, you know, it's like, there's these things where I'm like, I do have a hard time asking for favors in that sense of like, can you make this introduction or, I have like a, I'll do it on my own kind of thing going on.
But you will do it on behalf of an entity that is not you, solely you. You'll do it for Britannic. You'll do it for other things. Like you know, to have Joss Whedon come and do that video. Like it was such an easy thing because Britannic is something that you care for almost as a separate entity. You're willing to go above and beyond for those things.
Britannic is pretty, I mean, it's me and Nick, but it's almost as close to my heart as my own identity is at this point. But because it isn't Brian, because it does represent something that's not fully me, I do have more courage with it to ask for things or to have people look at it. Or I don't know, like there's something when I can just be like, this is for Britannic. I'm a little bit more confident in.
I know exactly how that feels because I've been able to do things for RGP development that I can't seem to get done for my own like when I did the table read for the script I wrote, Our Weekend in Vegas with Barack Obama, that was such a stretch for me. I was so uncomfortable like going after that, and then now that it's filmed, like I really want to get it in front of people, but I can't sell it in the way that I can sell what we do at RGP Development with that enthusiasm, because for me it feels selfish, it feels manipulative. But when I'm doing it for RGP Development, it feels bigger and better, even though like comedy is necessary, and I do believe in my heart of hearts that script is fucking hysterical. But for whatever reason, like the way in which I show up, my way of being shifts. Like I can't sell myself. I can sell something that I'm a part of as long as I'm not the sole thing or even like the main thing.
I get that. Yeah.
Thank God I do not suffer from that.
No, you don't. No.
What do you suffer from? Because do you have imposter syndrome, Rodrigo? And if so, are you willing to admit it for this audience of thousands?
I mean, yes. I have it every once in a while. And I feel like I have it every time I have a breakthrough in what I can achieve and therefore how people are perceiving me. But before opening that up, Brian doesn't really have imposter syndrome because Brian has Peter Pan syndrome. So for anyone who's still confused listening to us,
how did that come out here?
I'll go there.
Oh, no. At high roll.
Yeah, it's like I fucking knew this one. I mean, I've been denying this fucking guy beside me.
Okay. Just for everyone listening to understand, imposter syndrome is a very Jungian concept. And it talks about a stage that I feel... sorry. It talks about a stage that I feel like most human beings go through, which is when you achieve something, when you say something, or when you convince a group of people to see you and treat you a certain way, we all go into this cognitive dissonance of resisting and fighting against a result in front of us that doesn't seem to align perfectly with our beliefs. And if I don't think that I'm that worthy, but I'm pushing myself to be worthy, that's the famous fake it till you make it. The problem is that many times the difference between feeling like you're faking it and making it has nothing to do with tangible results, has nothing to do with money, followers, fame, success. It actually has to do with perception of oneself. And most people create results faster than they adjust their beliefs about themselves. In fact, we know that most people die without ever reviewing their beliefs about themselves. So usually what happens every time you grow fast in any type of career or any type of way, you go into imposter syndrome. And to portray it in a very basic way, if you have 5 siblings and suddenly you're the one that was able to answer a math question, even though you're the youngest one or the one in the middle and you knew more than the oldest ones, and then suddenly your family starts believing that you're the smartest one in the house, and you go like see yourself in the mirror and you ask yourself, is this true? Like, am I really the smartest? I don't think I am. That's imposter syndrome, where the image that you seem to have created in people around you does not match up with the beliefs that you have about yourself, which is something extremely common. So I feel like most people go through imposter syndrome. But then there's brilliant human beings that instead of falling into that and believing the imposter syndrome, what they do is that they have a smarter pattern. And this is not like an actual psychological term, but we call it Peter Pan syndrome. And Peter Pan syndrome is when you never want to commit with the idea of anything being permanent. And you're not growing. You want to stay childish with all of your possibilities open, so that you don't really have to define yourself in any way that removes possibilities and dreams from you. So you never really define yourself in any way because you're not growing.
Yeah, like I'm not a comedian. Also, I don't want to be in a relationship. Also, I don't live anywhere. Also, any other sort of element of my entire lifestyle. Yeah, I fucking get it.
Stop pressing the self-processing button, Brian.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Peter Pan syndrome's always been, I've always been like, yeah, do you want to be a kid forever? And so I'm like, I never really liked that version of it because I'm like, yeah, some ways yes, some ways no, though. But when you said it's just you don't want anything to be permanent, I was like, oh, fuck. That's exactly how I... And it's the truth, too. It's like I chase things that are always moving. It makes me comfortable. Well, what psychomagic act do I need to do now?
You need to make your movie, Brian.
I mean...
That's me. I don't know if
that'll be great fun. Yeah, I think that'll be great. I think it's going to... fix Peter Pan syndrome.
I think you fix it when you do a movie that Ross considers better than Jack and Joe.
Never gonna happen.
Good luck. Good luck, Brian.
I'm sorry, Brian. If I think that it's better than Jack and Jill, it works though.
Okay, cool. All right. Well.
No, I believe that Brian can blow Jack and Jill out of the water, and that's, I think, the highest compliment that I can give anybody at this moment. No, but I think, you know, we've talked about ever since we started hanging out, Brian, years ago. I was like, you know, talking to you about your projects and all these ideas that you have, and you're like, no, it's not good enough. And I'm like, I have moments that replay in my head that are just moments from scripts that you've told me about that you've written that don't actually exist yet. Like the Britannic pilot is so good. It was so watchable. Yeah. It was better than Workaholics. And that show ran for like 6 years. But
yeah, I liked it too.
Yeah. And it was really good. But anyway, I just, you know, my agenda of getting Brian.
Well, come see us in Scotland, everybody, if you can. That's sort of a big resurgence of everything we're doing.
But I think it's like, I would love to see what's Brian next level. Because like performing sketch shows, I've seen you
do. I agree.
Too.
Yeah, yeah. No,
Brian is getting so uncomfortable with this conversation because you're making things real and permanent.
No, then we should talk about it, because then I should be making things real and permanent. This is my psycho magic act, have you make something permanent for me.
A tattoo.
Interesting. Yeah, I've thought about getting tattoos before.
If you had to get a tattoo, what would it be?
I almost got one on my 30th birthday, and then I didn't, because, you know, of course.
Because tattoos are permanent.
There's one, my sister makes art, and she has this amazing one that's like a heart that I really want, like right here. But it's such an abstraction of like watercolor that like I just was like, I'm not going to get this done by a tattoo artist unless I know they're really good, because you just can't just haphazardly do it.
I think I might know someone. My friend got a really cool tattoo that has a
my
bit of a,
Rodrigo.
Yeah, I think you should just let Rodrigo tattoo you, man.
You know what? I think it's time.
This is
That's
how we become
magic. Guy.
No, this is how we become Nexium. No. Like, no, Brian.
That's literally what it's branding.
Yeah, yeah.
Brian's gonna get RGB in his crutch.
My crotch.
Hold on, I'm gonna see.
It's not a cult, guys. I do have the main guy's name on my dick.
What? What?
Exactly. Hold on, I'm gonna find a photo of this tattoo. Here we go. I found the photo.
While you look for the photo of the tattoo, I just wanted to answer a question in the chat really quick.
Okay.
Teresa was asking if there is a connection between imposter syndrome and mom and dad. Like, if you guys are avid listeners of the podcast, you know what she means by that. If not, look for an episode where we describe what's created by mom and dad, the way we interpret mom and the way we interpret dad.
The intro to Biotypical episode, link is in the show notes.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Thank you so much. So the way we interpret mom creates internal confidence. The way we interpret dad creates external confidence, confidence in our abilities and what we do. And just to answer Teresa's question, yes, people with more dad tend to have way more of very crippling and painful imposter syndrome than people with a lot of mom. Because people with a lot of mom feel worthy. So they feel like they deserve whatever's coming their way. They usually just ask themselves, like, are you ready? Are you ready for this? Because you deserve it. But people with a lot of dad that have amazing abilities, but that don't really trust their value and their self-esteem, actually do experience imposter syndrome most of their lives.
Wow, that's really interesting. That does make sense.
Can you see this?
Yeah.
This is, I mean, on an audio platform.
It's
no
great.
One else can.
No, yeah,
yeah.
It's,
yeah.
It's,
like, see, amazing. It has like a watercolor type feeling.
No, yeah, that's really great. Yeah. Maybe this is my person.
Okay.
That looks crazy.
Doesn't it? He got a Sherbert
ice like
cream
in
cone.
3D.
That seems like it's ripping through space and time.
The permanent thing, I'm reminded of, so when you do like stand-up shows sometimes, like they'll be like, how do you want to be introduced when you come out? And people will be like, oh, I want to be, say I wrote for this show, said I have this web series, you know, basically say your things. And so often I've told people, I'd be like, oh, just say the next guy is some asshole. Like, that's what I tell them to say. And then, like, because I'm like, I just don't say I did this and did this. That's not who I am. I'm so much more. Just call me, like, a dickhead and then have me come out. So I've, like, done that before, which is, again, this thing of, like, not labeling who I am in a space where you are literally supposed to be introduced by your labels. Like, you're given an invitation to.
I had a hard time with that. My jokes were, I forgot how I had people introduce me, but it was something like Nobel Prize winner, something like and a compulsive liar, please welcome, you know, like, so it's like,
that's a funny joke.
So yeah, thanks. Yeah. But like, I definitely get the discomfort with too much attention on me or too much serious attention on me. Right. Like, and I don't know if it's a responsibility thing or an expectations thing, but I've only noticed recently that I'm getting more and more comfortable with, well, actually, that's not true. I've gotten less and less comfortable with spotlight for certain things, but more and more comfortable in the discomfort of, like, if I'm going to get the things I want, I need to go through this anyway.
I have a bomb to drop on Brian.
What? What is it? Man, I thought we were done.
You're setting up the stage so well, my friend.
Okay, I'm here for it.
You ready for it?
Are you? Yeah, that's a good question.
As I'll ever be, I assume.
Have you noticed that there's something extremely comfortable in the way you see your future, even with no certainty? Like, there is a commitment not to go to the next level in many ways?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yes, I've always been very comfortable when people have been uncomfortable for me in, like, the fact that my future seems like a question mark. And I'm like, I'm fine with it. I haven't thought about the idea of, like, oh, that might be me. What you're trying to sort of get at is, because of my uncomfortability with the question mark of the future, that's in a way me being uncomfortable with growing to the next step as a person or an artist.
The way I'm thinking it, and this is not something that I had saved for you. This is something that I'm building as we're discussing this. When I see someone who's extremely talented and they're, like, clearly being mediocre, there's always something to realize about what belief, fear, or brokenness they still have that's hindering them from achieving a specific level. In your case, I would never consider you a mediocre human being, which is interesting. That, like, that's not my experience of you at all. And you're very open about how talented you are. So the only other answer, and this is what I was building in my head, the only other answer is systemic. And as soon as I thought systemically, it makes total sense given the pattern that we've discovered so far. Not being a problem also means not creating a lot of attention to yourself. Not being, like, braggy and arrogant about what it means to be you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's been kind of something. We sort of talked about this a bit in BYB, where it was like this weird thing where don't create attention for yourself. And at the same time, I did feel like I had to pick up the pieces that my sister couldn't, where I had to be, I excelled in school and everything, because I was the only kid that could do that in our family. But then if it got too big, I'd be like, whoa, I'm not allowed. It was kind of like, it felt unfair. It's like I wasn't allowed to be too low or too high. I had to kind of ping pong between both of them or something. And so I feel like the class is a question. Yes, Ross?
So I thought the systemic loyalty was more towards his parents, but it looks like the systemic loyalty in this case is towards his sister. So
I've always known that it's with his sister.
Oh, so Mike, Brian, like, is his thing here, he needs to have a conversation with his sister and kind of ask her what she wants for him, or like actually have a conversation with her about any of this? Like, what's the thing here?
I don't think the conversation's with her, because she could feel very guilty with this conversation. But it is a conversation with the place that you've given your sister in your heart and your parents a little bit. Like, it sounds like it's time for you to come to terms with the fact that you might be ready to take it to another level, and you're not being disrespectful towards anyone for doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely had that in my head for a while. I mean, since I kind of started working with you guys, that, like, I think I'm I live in this space where I'm kind of like this, I still feel like this like good little boy of our family. Like, I feel like a kid. Like I'm even when I'm with my parents and my family or when I go back for Christmas, I kind of take on this role of like, I don't know, I feel almost weird if I were to, like, I have so many friends that like don't see their parents as often as I do, and they go off and they're very successful with what they do. And part of me like judges them for it, 'cause I'm like, oh, why aren't you like, you know, at home for this much of time during Christmas break? And why aren't you like seeing them this much and doing all these things? And why are you acting like you're the adult now? And it's just, they've grown up and out of that system. And I kind of, I don't know. I'm like, I definitely find myself like going back into that world with my family way harder when I do, more than almost anyone else I know. And I used to be like, good for me, I'm like staying, you know, the person that I was when I was a kid, which they loved and I loved being. But at the same time, I'm like, oh yeah, that's probably, there is, I don't know, there's probably something that makes me feel guilty about like being a man and like going off and like being a successful, you know, person in this world that is apart from them. Which feels weird because I have done a bomb. Yeah.
I think I know what it is.
Okay.
You would stop needing them.
Hmm.
And you'd become another adult that doesn't really need their parents or can connect with a sister the way you can.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I definitely had two parents who, like, when I talk about my parents and their relationship, it was so steady from what I gathered growing up. Like, they were in their mid-30s when they had me. They're both therapists. I've never seen them yell, feel out of line. I don't think I've ever seen them do anything that felt childish. Like, they just, like, had everything, in my perception, handled. And they took care of all my needs and let me be a kid entirely when I was a kid. And I feel like I still kind of use them in that way. And
how does adulthood look, given what you experienced growing up with a couple that was so steady and clear and formal about being adults? That must create like a very rigid image and idea of what permanence, responsibility, and adulthood looked like.
Yeah, I think so. Because also they had to take care of my sister too, and they did that 100%. That was their journey, 100%. I was not, the younger sibling didn't do that. So it was like, yeah, I had this freedom to play. It was like a very strong divide between childhood and adulthood. Childhood was this amazing space I got to play in, and adulthood was this place that looked, you know, I was very appreciative I had them there to be those people, but I didn't want to cross that boundary.
Do you guys remember when we talked about generations and how people dress up as children and as adults?
Yes.
How we always assume that at some point a switch will happen and we'll become what we understood in our head as being an adult growing up. Yeah, Brian's running away from it and just waiting for the other shoe to drop. And I completely identify myself with you, my friend, because there's still a part of me that's waiting for me to become what I thought an adult was going to be.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That is so true.
Yeah, and I think for a long time, I also, you know, as you know, my 20s happened and everything, I was still rewarded for it because I was like really fun and exciting. And like that was like, people didn't mind. It was like cool to have like a friend around like me, I think, even when my friends were, let's say, growing up in their own ways. And now I'm at the age where I'm like, this is going to crash hard. Like, it's cute for a while, but like, you know, if I hit 40 and I'm still kind of like in that same place, and I'm not saying that, I mean, I already feel like I've started making steps in the past few years. I don't look at myself as like a lost cause, but like, I'm definitely like, this is, I don't want to be just that. I want to hold a sense of maturity and responsibility that I used to really hate the idea of. And sometimes I'm like scared that I can't ever get there. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, I'm like not ever. I know in my head that I'm saying I want to do it, but am I really doing it? And I'll see behavior where I'm like, here I am kind of just being, you know, this this kid again. And then I'll get mad that I get mad at myself. And then I'll get in the loop where I'm like, be kind to yourself. But then I'll be like, oh, maybe actually I should sort of kick my own ass a bit. I don't know. It can get complicated sometimes.
I feel like the only thing that's painful with you, because you really seem to enjoy like the way you live, and you're not like toxic for anyone around you. Like on the contrary, the only angle where I can see this becoming dangerous, and I've heard Jordan Peterson explain this multiple times, is when we find a very functional way of living with our trauma, even a successful one, we tend to make certain decisions that keep us usually in a really lonely position, like in a controlled way, like with as few risks and as we can, not to lose control. And it works beautifully in our 20s, even works pretty well in our 30s, but around 45 we start getting really lonely. And sometimes because we're experiencing our 30s, like I'm 39, and just thinking about 40 makes me feel like, yeah, that's old. Like, that's a grown-up. But hey, life expectancy in the world is over 80. That means that by the time I'm 40, I'm not even 50% through my life. And sometimes people forget that. And by the time you are 40, 45, yeah, you're a grown-up. You're an adult. But you maybe still have 30, 40 more years to go. And if you're not creating solid like structures that are permanent around you, you won't have the energy to do them at 50. And it gets lonely.
I mean, I've noticed that even now. It's like, it's so weird because I spend so much time, even now, just like wandering New York. Like I spend so much time writing and being alone as an artist. And I luckily have moments where I get to be on set or be writing with Nick or something. But I'm like, how have I created a world that I'm so lonely so often? And I am an extrovert who loves being with people. And yet I find myself in these systems. I liked going to school as a kid. I liked being a part of groups. And I say that, but I've developed this lifestyle where I am wandering on my own often. And that's really interesting to me that I've done that.
Are we one of the most permanent things in your life?
I mean, yeah, at this point, a weekly event where I see you two, yeah, I don't know where else I have something like that. Yeah, probably.
I feel very honored by that.
But people are pretty, like, you have a lot of long-term friendships.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really good at long-term friendships.
Yeah,
I keep friends. Yes. Relationships, not so much. Friendships, yes.
We know many of them, and they're fascinating human beings.
I keep friends, man. I'm really good at that, especially the close
you
ones.
You do.
Which is interesting, because I know some people that have a really hard time keeping that part of their life permanent, and I've not had an issue
with
that.
That's where I actually have a hard time. I have Andrew. Were you about to drop
a bomb on me? I can explain why for both of you.
All right, let's do it.
The reason why Brian can keep so many of his friends...
He asked nothing of them.
Well, in a sense, yeah. Because Brian takes a level of intimacy and connection and like giving and understanding into casual relationships because of the lack of like structure and permanence that blows people's minds. And like people that are used to relating like that are not ready for the level of intimacy and connection that Brian can create momentarily. At the same time, I feel like Ross suffers from the absolute opposite. He has such rigid, important, valuable structures with specific people in his life that casual conversations in order to get to that level for someone else would take 20 years.
Wait, hold on. So I have an inability to do small talk and Brian is a wizard at it?
Yes,
is that
you
what
do.
It is? Yeah, I agree with this 1,000%. I'm just making sure I'm understanding.
Like literally what I'm saying is, The way Brian keeps friends, even when he sees them once a year or once every 2 years and has like a meaningful conversation every like few months or something like that, because he doesn't have the permanence and structure that other people our age have built, then he has all this like extra energy. Like, I'll give it to you like this. I have a wife and a son. I travel around the world like crazy. If one of my best friends from middle school needs to talk to me, it usually takes me a couple of weeks to find space to actually talk to them. And by the time I'm there, because I love them, but I do not have any energy. But when I was single and I was just traveling around like crazy, I had time to create the intimate connections with strangers on the street the way Brian does. Uh-huh. And I love watching it. Like, that's something that I admire about you massively, Brian. But I understand that it has a lot to do with not having the girlfriend, not having the structure, not having the things that are permanent, allows this whole like space of intimacy and time and energy to be available. And that just rekindles relationships with friends that you haven't seen in years and makes them never let you go. And then on the other side, Ross, you have so much, like so many of those like very specific relationships, because not only do you have Andrew, like you have a lot of people that consider you one of their closest friends and people that you really are there for, that you would like run in their direction if they need you. You're that type of friend. Like, I'm always saying that everybody deserves a phlegmatic human being in their lives because they're the most unconditional, loyal human beings that exist. Now, after a certain age, when you have so much that you value and so much structure, then creating casual relationships that start becoming more and more,
they feel exhausting. It's like I don't have the bandwidth. Yeah, I've been going through, like, whenever I hop on Facebook, you know, as rare as that is, I'm just deleting Facebook friends because I'm like, I met you once at a thing, I don't care, like I forget who you are, kind of thing. But
20 years ago,
yeah, but I you know, I don't, I've noticed this, that I have a hard time doing small talk because, like, all I want to do is like get into the nitty gritty. The people that I bond the closest with are those that can participate in deeper philosophical conversations and are usually people that have similar worldviews as mine. Like, that's where it's easy for me. If they have a different worldview, sometimes I really struggle internally just keeping my mouth shut and nodding along, you know?
Yeah. I noticed that for the longest time, I could never not engage. Like, if I got in an Uber and they told me something that I didn't agree with politically, or I just noticed a difference that I could make psychologically with them because they were like opening up about their relationship with their girlfriend and all, like, yeah, reality is not even close to what you're expressing, so let me break this down a little bit and let me ask you questions. Like, I will do that every time. Like, last weekend that I was in Merida doing a biotype corporate workshop, I was telling them that when I was building my whole diagram of biotypes, I was asking questions all the time and validating certain things and asking people to show me their hands and like going to very deep conversations. And in that period, I was going to Monterrey a lot to see Danny. And I made a system for Uber drivers not to charge me. And what I did is I got in the cab, I would start talking to them, and midway there, I would tell them, do you want me to explain? Because I would start asking questions. And then I would go like, do you want me to explain everything about why your relationship works the way it does and how to fix it? And they would go like, oh yeah, sure. Like, I want to hear. And then I would tell them, you feel like this. The relationship is like this. Your partner is always like demanding this and arguing about that. And they would immediately stop the trip and go like, if I don't charge you anything for the rest of the trip, can I just ask questions? And I really enjoyed doing it. Like, it was fun. I felt like I was making a difference, and I also felt very validated and important. Like, it was nice. I loved it. Now I realize that I get on cabs and they go like, how are you? And I don't want to answer. Like, I don't even want to start a conversation.
Well, when we all went to the comedy show at the Bowl, right?
Yeah.
There was that group of people next to us, and Brian, like, next thing we know, he's in a conversation with them. Like, he's you know, he's talking.
He's smoking their joint.
Yeah. But then the people that we hung out with, like, later in the night, it was, you know, it became therapy with Rodrigo, which is always fun to watch. It's like, you know, believe me, it's one of my favorite things. But, like, Brian is a casual encounter. I'm a deep, intimate relationship, and you're their therapist. Mm-hmm.
And with that, good night, everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I just keep thinking about it. Do I want to be known as that or seen as that? In a way, I'm like, yeah, I love that about myself. And sometimes it's very frustrating.
What do you want, Brian? Let's build it for you. You deserve the world.
You really do. And I'm so in admiration of the way in which Brian goes into these conversations.
I know.
It's amazing. Truly.
I'm just talking. Thanks. Dan asked, what are the tags I chose when I went to go see In and of Itself?
Oh, that's a good question.
I chose something different every time, because of course I did. I didn't want to label myself the same thing. All 13 what? Times, something different. Whatever I felt that day.
Were you a different human being in that occasion?
Yes, that's how I felt. I was a new me. I was going through something different that hour of that day.
On one side, that's extremely liberating. And on the other side, that's a little bit schizophrenizante.
Schizophrenic.
We speak Spanish for that word
but
only.
But schizophrenizante doesn't mean schizophrenico. Schizophrenico is schizophrenic. Schizophrenizante means like giving you the experience of someone with schizophrenia. Like nothing is permanent. What can I believe in? What's true? What's real?
Yeah. Yeah. And then that question goes to my head all the time. And that's, I love dissecting things comedically because of that. There's no real truth. There's every angle of something. Like, how can I explore this or that part of it? I think in a way, there's a good part of it for when you write comedy or you try to, you know, you need to create characters. You need to kind of have a slippery mind that can kind of go in a lot of different locations. But it can also be too slippery sometimes in real life. And you're like, oh, God. I need an anchor. So,
in other words, who are you?
I don't know who I am.
Well, I know where Brian's anchor is.
I'm Brian. I'm marbles.
Yeah. Brian's anchor is at home with his parents. Because that's the, like, no matter where in the world you are or whatever's going on in your life, you can always go back to that house and that's home for you.
Yeah.
But he can't, though. Because you can't play the role of the child for the rest of your life.
But I mean, like, for right now.
No one will need that child.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to create kind of some other new version of home base.
Really excited to see what you build on the other side, because this is not, like, psychologically urgent or anything that puts you in danger.
Yeah.
And given what I know about you, it's just fun to imagine the things that you're going to come up with and who you're going to be on the other side. And we'll be there for you if you hit yourself against the wall for taking
which I will.
To wake up.
You know, Brian, here's what I think.
I think sometimes I can get in these places, like, because I do feel very lucky and successful and talented and all those things. Like, whenever I do something, I feel like, oh, yeah, I did well with this. I don't feel undeserving of it. But there are times where I can feel very lost and completely out of power sometimes. Like, I'll feel like if my career or life isn't going in the right place, I can get in this place where I feel like I don't even know how to put one foot in front of the other to get there. And I look at everyone else and I think that they're just sort of like completely in command of their lives. And I can feel like fully out of it, like, and it's like not up to me, and I'm just waiting for someone else to like help me get there. And I don't know, I can get that space sometimes where I feel out of power.
Just for you to know, and for everybody listening that feels like similar, because I know that a lot of people feel exactly like that. No one has their shit together. No one. Like, you know that I deal with like hundreds of people from every social status, and no one has their shit together. Like, even the people that seem like they have it all down and they know exactly who they are and where they're going, they don't. Remember that when someone has that level of certainty, that's not their certainty. That's the system's certainty feeding them. Now, like, having said that, I feel like that's the magic and freedom of human beings. And you can take advantage of this from your position. Like, most people believe that there is something fixed. And you don't, which is actually an advantage. Now, the real question is, would you be willing to lose the freedom of your lifestyle and the looseness of the concept of who you are within your life right now in order to achieve what you have never achieved? Because that's usually what gets in the way. Like, am I willing to bet who I am today in order to achieve what I've never achieved before?
Yes, I I've sensed that that's kind of my fork in the road coming up. And my answer to that intellectually is, yeah, I would. I think I need to. And just talking about it doesn't really scare me. Then it's like, well, in practicality, what does that mean? And like, what do I actually need to do that?
And I can give you a little tool to like know when it's happening.
Want more Biotypical? Well, good news, there's a longer version of this episode available at patreon.com/rgpdevelop. There, you'll also be able to find ways to get on the podcast yourself, ask questions, as well as watch a live taping remotely. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast and subscribing. Remember to rate this 5 stars wherever you're listening to it, and we'll see you next time.